Hello, it's Thursday the 26th of February. I'm John Dennis. Today, Westminster in mourning, the tragic death of David Cameron's six-year-old son.
Everybody knew that Ivan Cameron was profoundly ill, but obviously there was great shock when people heard the news.
Also today, air accident investigators are trying to find out what caused a Turkish Airlines passenger jet to crash as it approached Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport, killing at least 9 people.
They couldn't believe that they had only got out with a bad headache and a few eye problems. I mean, it really is quite incredible.
And Europe's Las Vegas, a mini city of casinos, hotels and theme parks in eastern Spain.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Bill Overton has the news headlines and the papers.
The Royal Bank of Scotland has posted the largest ever loss by a British corporation. This comes the day after it was revealed the bank's former chief executive, Sir Fred Goodwin, will receive a pension worth £650,000 a year for the rest of his life, even though he's only 50 years old. Meanwhile, RBS announced its plans to offload toxic assets into a government insurance programme. RBS is Britain's second largest bank and it's majority owned by the government after it accepted bailout packages worth more than £20 billion. The government plans to publish its bill to part-privatise the Royal Mail today, along outspoken opposition from Labour's 8 largest unions. In a letter to The Guardian, the unions, which represent 2.5 million people, call the postal reforms electorally unpopular, politically unwise and damaging to the postal service. The business secretary, Lord Mandelson, will seek to reassure detractors by guaranteeing that Royal Mail is not completely privatised without further legislation, that a universal letter service 6 days a week at a single affordable price will be enshrined in law, and that the regulator, Ofcom, will get extensive powers to investigate the Royal Mail's prices. Mandelson also guarantees the first class and second class post, next day special deliveries and the parcel service. Politicians of all parties have united in shock and sympathy after Conservative leader David Cameron's son died suddenly following an epileptic seizure. Ivan Cameron, aged 6, had suffered from cerebral palsy and a rare form of epilepsy since birth. He fell ill yesterday morning at his West London home and he was pronounced dead a few minutes after arrival at St Mary's Hospital. A statement on the Conservative Party website said the couple were grateful for all the warm messages of support and condolence they've received. In the Commons, Prime Minister's questions were suspended as a mark of sympathy for the first time since the death of the Labour leader John Smith in 1994. A visibly moved Gordon Brown, whose newborn daughter Jennifer died 7 years ago, led the expressions of sympathy. He said the death of a child was an unbearable sorrow no parent should ever have to endure. Bangladesh was last night coming to terms with a military mutiny after border guards revolted against their top officers in a brief but bloody uprising that reportedly claimed up to 50 lives. The recently elected Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, announced an amnesty for the mutineers after meeting 14 of their leaders from the Bangladesh Rifles, the border security force. Mrs. Hasina was sworn into office last month, and the uprising is her government's first crisis. The rebels said complaints about their pay and promotion and alleged corruption had been ignored. The Prime Minister agreed to consider their demands, and last night, rebels began disarming. After promising his daughters a dog for the White House during his acceptance speech, the breed of the dog has been revealed. First Lady Michelle Obama told People magazine the family wants to find a rescued Portuguese water dog known for their intelligence for their daughters Malia and Sasha. Malia is allergic to certain breeds and the Portuguese water dog is hypoallergenic. It's not yet known what the name of the first dog will be, although the names Frank and Moose have been mentioned. And now look at the headlines. The death of opposition leader David Cameron's son Ivan dominates the tabloids and the broadsheets this morning. Images of Mr Cameron holding and kissing his son are shown alongside photos of the grieving parents. Mr Cameron described Ivan as our beautiful boy. The government's plan to guarantee £600 billion of the toxic assets of Britain's two biggest banks is outlined on the front of the Times. According to the front page of The Independent, 21,000 doses of the meningitis C vaccine were withdrawn after it emerged they may be contaminated with a potentially lethal blood-poisoning bacterium. And the head of the Financial Services Authority promises to be tougher on banks. That from the Financial Times and the Daily Telegraph. And those are the headlines today. More news updated throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
David Cameron's son, Ivan, suffered from a rare form of cerebral palsy and severe epilepsy. He needed round-the-clock care throughout his life. Just 6 years old, Ivan died on Tuesday night at St Mary's Hospital in Paddington, in West London. The Conservative Party leader and his wife, Samantha, were at Ivan's side. In the House of Commons yesterday, Prime Minister's questions were cancelled at the suggestion of Gordon Brown. The last time that happened was in 1994 after the death from a sudden heart attack of the Labour leader John Smith. The Guardian's chief political correspondent, Nicholas Watt, says there was a sombre mood at Westminster.
Well, MPs from across the House in all parties were deeply saddened when they came into work yesterday and heard the news about Ivan Cameron. Everybody knew that Ivan Cameron was profoundly ill and that he had severe epilepsy and cerebral palsy and that the prognosis was not good. But obviously there was great, great shock when people heard the news. Obviously at a human level, people were sad to hear that a six-year-old had died. But also there's a great deal of respect for David and Samantha Cameron and the way in which they have dealt with this very, very difficult situation. David Cameron said that when Ivan was born in April 2002, and it became quickly, not immediately, but within a few weeks, that their son was very, very ill. He talked about how he had been hit by, like a freight train. David Cameron spoke quite openly about the impact that it had and how he and Samantha Cameron in the initial weeks used to have to take it in turns to sleep on the hospital floors as the tests were conducted on their son. And there is general respect on all sides of the House for the way they handled it.
Is it possible to say, Nick, how Ivan affected David Cameron's political outlook?
I think that Ivan Cameron had a profound impact on David Cameron. I think the most important thing we should look at is not political but personal, which is that it really cemented David and Samantha Cameron's marriage. They are a fantastically happy couple. They always have been. But what they went through in the initial months and the first years after Ivan Cameron's diagnosis, that really tests a couple, and couples who are weaker couples, who have a weaker marriage, may not have survived it. David and Samantha Cameron didn't just survive it. They've emerged as a much, much stronger couple and a much, much stronger family. I think that's the most important thing. But yes, at a political level, David Cameron has changed. Ivan's condition brought him and Samantha Cameron in contact with the NHS, with social services, with speech therapists, as he says, all sorts of people in the NHS and public services. And that has changed him. It's made him realise how important public services are. It's also enabled him to talk about them in a completely natural way. And people do say that the David Cameron of the mid-1990s, when he was a special advisor to Michael Howard, and then when the Tories lost power in 1997 and he became an executive at Carlton TV, he was a traditional sort of Etonian Tory. Slick back hair, red braces, Eurosceptic, law and order, that was the name of the day. That's not how we see David Cameron today. He is a very different person who really does care about public services, who talks about them from the heart and is genuine about it.
By grim coincidence, Gordon Brown also lost a child. His baby daughter Jennifer died in 2002, and the Brown's second son, Fraser, suffers from the disabling lung disease cystic fibrosis. How has that affected Gordon Brown?
Well, it meant that when Prime Minister's questions yesterday was suspended after about 10 minutes of tributes from Gordon Brown, from William Hague and from Vince Cable, it meant that when the Prime Minister spoke, he spoke from the heart and he spoke very powerfully. The Prime Minister said the death of a child is an unbearable sorrow no parent should have to endure. And that, you know, that when the Prime Minister is saying that, that's not just words that appeared to him and his spin doctor. Those are words that come from the heart, because obviously he suffered in a similar way.
I know that the whole House will want to express our sorrow at the sad death this morning of Ivan Cameron at the age of just 6 years old. And our condolences go out to David, to Samantha, and to the Cameron family. I know that in an all too brief young life, he brought joy to all those around him. And I know also that for all the days of his life, he was surrounded by his family's love. Every child is precious and irreplaceable. And the death of a child is an unbearable sorrow that no parent should ever have to endure. Politics can sometimes divide us, but there is a common human bond that unites us in sympathy and compassion at times of trial, and in support for each other at times of grief. Sarah and I have sent our condolences to David and Samantha, and I know that the whole country, our thoughts and our prayers are with David, Samantha and their family today.
Amen. Gordon Brown yesterday, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on the Guardian's website today, is our recycling actually being recycled? Leo Hickman investigates at guardian.co.uk/environment. Our art critic, Jonathan Jones, on why he judges albums by their covers. He says he knows it's not big or clever, and it made him a Pink Floyd fan, but he still buys albums on the strength of their artwork. guardian.co.uk/arts. And Emily Bell on why so few MPs are up to speed with using the web. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. A Turkish Airlines jet carrying 127 passengers crashed yesterday as it prepared to land at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. At least 9 people died and more than 50 were injured as the plane split into three. The Guardian's Lizzie Davis is at Schiphol. She says that looking at the damage to this plane, it's hard to believe that there weren't more fatalities.
Well, it is indeed fairly miraculous. And actually, one of the survivors that I spoke to last night, a man called Orhan Kok, he told me that he felt lucky to be alive. He was on the flight with his wife and his 4-year-old daughter, Maya. And he told me that they couldn't quite believe what had happened. And given the damage and the pain, the fact that it just kind of broke into pieces in front of his eyes, as he told me, they couldn't believe that they had only got out with a bad headache and a few eye problems. I mean, it really is quite incredible.
Absolutely terrifying for those on board.
Absolutely. I mean, if you can imagine everything going smoothly up until moments before landing and then feeling a huge downwards lurch. Witnesses have told me that they saw smoke coming through into the cabin, hearing a big bang and total panic among all the passengers, people starting to cry, people starting to pray, and then hitting the ground and then landing in a meadow. I mean, it must have been absolutely terrifying.
Presumably there's quite a large area that's been sealed off while air accident investigators try to find out what happened to this plane.
Yeah, that's right. The A9 motorway, which goes past the meadow where the plane landed near the runway, that's been closed off. The airport was closed off for a while, flights very much disrupted, but now the airport is back open. And now it's really hard to actually get to the area where the plane came down. There have been lines of yellow Dutch ambulances kind of lining up, trying to take people away, trying to clear the wreckage. It's very clear that this is a major, major disaster.
Lizzie Davis in Amsterdam. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, the government presses ahead with the part privatisation of the Royal Mail. But first, Barack Obama publishes a budget today aimed at halving the deficit while increasing spending on health, education and climate change. The new president will flesh out his plans he described in his speech to Congress on Tuesday, which wasn't technically a State of the Union speech, but might as well have been. Our Washington correspondent, Ewan McCaskill, says that in his speech, Obama needed to again stress the severity of the problems facing America, principally the economic recession, while returning to his pre-election message of hope.
I mean, the main thing Barack Obama had to do was to offer Americans some hope that this awful economic crisis was going to come to an end. You know, for months, ever since he was elected president in November, he's repeatedly stressed that this crisis is one of the worst that America has faced since the 1930s. It's all been doom and gloom. He piles one bad statistic on another, and nowhere has there been any sort of inkling of when it might come to an end. So on Tuesday night, Obama offered the sort of first hint there could be an end in sight. Earlier that day, the chairman of the Federal Reserve give us more specifics. He said this economic recession is going to become worse over the next 6 months, but recovery may begin next year. And that was the first sort of good news that Americans have heard in the last couple of years.
How did the Republicans respond to Obama's speech?
Well, on the night, quite a lot of Republicans were bouncing off chairs to applaud him. But that's just a sort of traditional thing. There's a sign of respect for the president. But Bobby Jindal, the Louisiana governor who replied on behalf of the Republicans, he was pretty scathing about Obama's plan. Traditional Republican standpoint, don't throw federal money at a problem. Leave it to American individuals to sort it out for themselves. And you do that by cutting taxes. Spending lots of federal money is not the way forward. And even in the chamber itself, quite a few Republicans didn't get on their feet for Obama. They were sort of sitting there, slumped, fairly disdainful and looking fairly unimpressed. So the battle lines between the Democrats and Republicans have hardened in spite of Obama's repeated calls for bipartisanship.
And what's been the reaction to Obama's speech outside Capitol Hill?
The initial polls carried out by, you know, CBS and CNN and Stan Greenberg and, you know, other pollsters have all been pretty favourable. You know, I think if Obama had done his usual sort of campaign speech, all sort of rhetoric and high-blown sentiments, it wouldn't have worked. But the speech lasted 52 minutes, and he sort of slowly set out, like, here's a way of getting out of this economic mess. And it was very, very sort of almost subdued, almost pedestrian pace. But he did set out in a fair amount of detail what he planned to do. Well, one of the criticisms today is that there hasn't been enough detail in the speech. And today he will set out his budget, and the Bush administration officials say that the kind of detail that was missing on Tuesday night should be in the budget today.
Ewan McCaskill in Washington. The government publishes a bill today setting out its proposals for selling off part of the Royal Mail, probably to the Dutch contractor TNT. 125 Labour MPs have signed an early day motion opposing such a move. Well, a Commons vote is unlikely to happen before the autumn, but as things stand, it will have to rely on the support of the Conservatives in order to be passed into law. Dan Roberts, our head of business, explains the problems facing the Royal Mail.
The big long-term problem is that people are sending, are using letters less and less. People are using email and other forms of electronic communication. The other problem with the Royal Mail, as far as the government's concerned, is that it's been run in a very sort of old-fashioned way for a long time and has been, you know, not very open to change and hasn't been modernised properly. The unions and others would argue differently and say that actually the Royal Mail has been starved of cash for years, that actually the Treasury sucked it dry when it was profitable and is now not putting money back in when it's not.
You see, they don't want to modernise, they want to privatise. Look at the railways. Who thinks the railways are working? Who thinks the water works well, or gas or electricity? No, this is the Thatcher policy being carried for in the name of modernisation. It has nothing to do with modernisation at all. And you see, they're going to pick up the pension fund, the government are, in order to make the post office profitable for somebody else to buy it. I mean, it's what Vince Cable once said about you nationalise the losses and privatise the profits. New Labour is a Thatcherite party. I mean, Mrs. Thatcher said, when asked her greatest achievement, she said New Labour. And they put plenty of money in the banks, haven't they? And you know what will happen if this company that want to buy part of the post office got into difficulties. What would they do? They'd pour money into it, as they did with the banks.
That's Tony Bennett, a protest on Tuesday. Dan, what's the government proposing to do in this bill?
Well, they'd like to bring in a private sector partner and part privatise the Royal Mail by selling 30% of it to TNT. And this is proving hugely controversial because people see it as the thin end of the wedge and they're worried that this would lead to full privatisation. The other thing is the government has tried to lump together various reforms at once and says that if they can bring in a private sector partner, they can also help solve the pension crisis. The unions and others are arguing that these are completely unrelated issues and that actually if you want to solve the pension crisis, then you have to put some money into the pension fund.
And the pension scheme won't be guaranteed even after this sell-off?
Well, not explicitly, but there is an extent to which all pension schemes have some form of government backing, because take BT, for example. At one stage, BT and Royal Mail were part of the same organisation before BT was privatised. The government is still on the hook for BT's pension liabilities, and if for some reason BT were ever to go bust or were to not be able to meet its pension liabilities, the government would probably have to step in. So to an extent, that's always in the background with any large employer like this.
And a lot of people will wonder why the government is willing to throw billions bailing out the banks, but balk at investing a comparatively small amount of money in getting the Royal Mail back into shape.
Yes, well, the banks is a whole kettle of fish. I mean, the government's argument is that the banking crisis is systemic, and that if it doesn't sort out the banks, then the rest of the economy could be dragged down. But they're going to be facing these challenges all the way across, you know, whether it's saving LDV, the van maker, or whether it's bailing out the car industry more generally. I mean, the pressure on Mandelson at the moment to put his hand in our pockets and spend public money rescuing businesses is intense. The government has got a point in that there isn't, you know, times are very tight, public spending is going to be very tight, and that they would rather not have to put more money into the Royal Mail.
Although this one is slightly different in that it's already 100% state-owned.
Yes, and I think the other thing is that for a long time the Royal Mail was very profitable and paid a lot of money to the Treasury, and it's become less profitable, partly because of the changes, people using more email and so forth, but also partly because competition has been encouraged and private sector operators have been nibbling away at its more profitable activities. So the government has a responsibility here. It can't just sort of walk away, but its preferred solution clearly is to bring in TNT.
How will TNT affect services?
It's hard to say. I mean, they've had a checkered record. Some would argue that they're much more efficient. They've also been schemes where TNT have been less than effective. And it's not clear to me why necessarily they would, at a stroke, find solutions to all these issues that Royal Mail's been grappling for years. It would still be a heavily unionised business. It would still be a business in decline. It would still be a business with big issues. There's some very smart private sector expertise already at the top of Royal Mail. I mean, Adam Crozier and Alan Layton, who've been running it for the last few years, are both extremely smart guys from private sector experience. So if that was just the answer, then you would have thought they would have cracked it already.
This bill's likely to be passed with the help of the Conservatives. Are there any concessions the government could pull out of the hat that might persuade Labour rebels to back this bill?
Well, they're already throwing a few of them in their direction. One of them would be that they would have to publish a new bill were they to go for full privatisation, because that's the sneaking suspicion at the moment, is this is a thin end of the wedge. So if the government were to guarantee that if they were to go to the next step, it would have to come back to Parliament, that would be one concession that they might offer to MPs. The other things that they're trying to do is sort of relax the regulatory controls around Royal Mail. So, for example, the pricing formula that's agreed with the regulators to keep stamp prices under control, that may be relaxed. These are all areas where you then start pitting Royal Mail against the consumers, because as consumers we quite want strict regulation. So there are concessions the government can make, but everywhere it goes it's going to come up against more opposition.
Dan Roberts. A British consortium is to build a casino city across 3,000 hectares of eastern Spain, about 2 hours from Barcelona. Developers hope it will be Europe's answer to Las Vegas, with 32 casino hotels, 18 theme parks and 17,000 hotel places. With the details is Giles Tremlett in Madrid.
In the bigger sense, what is being proposed is to build a massive gambling and leisure complex, something that could be a rival on the global scale, shall we say, to Las Vegas, Orlando, or Atlantic City, or Macau.
So we're talking about a large-scale development. I mean, it's a whole town, in effect, of
yes,
hotels and casinos.
Indeed, we're talking about a large town, a city worth of hotels and casinos, of theme parks. They want to build 32 hotel casinos. They want to do 18 theme parks, of which six are deemed to be large and the rest medium size. 70,000 hotel places, all in an area of some 3,000 hectares, which is being bought as we speak.
You know, what do the locals think about this?
You might think the locals would be worried, but actually what's happening is that the company is paying top whack for the land. In some cases, it's offering up to 30 times the market price. And so generally, people are delighted. Those who aren't are in trouble, because local politicians have simply said they will expropriate their land if they don't sell it anyway.
And what's the terrain like? Because obviously Las Vegas is in the middle of the Nevada desert.
This is in Los Monegros, which is a desert-like area of Spain. It's actually on one side of it, so it's slightly greener, shall we say, than the rest of it, though not very. No, it's non-irrigated land, as someone said to me yesterday. Said, well, here what we do is we sow our cereal crops and pray for rain.
Obviously, Nevada's got quite liberal gaming laws, much more liberal than here in Britain, for instance. What about Spain's gaming laws? What sort of restrictions will there be on the kind of gambling that we might see in this development?
gaming laws in Spain are in the hands of regional governments, and in this case, the regional government of Aragon seems to be desperately keen to get this centre set up. With the current gambling law, it couldn't be done because you're only allowed, I think, one casino within a province, and certainly not 32 within a few square miles. So they're simply going to rewrite the law and do something which I think could be described as made to measure for this project.
It's quite an ambitious project, given that we're heading towards a severe worldwide recession.
It's hugely ambitious. I mean, who knows whether it will ever really happen in the end. Certainly, you know, money is being spent on it and land is being bought. That doesn't mean that the developers can then persuade everyone else who they want to invest in it to put money into it as well. You know, their figures talk of things opening in 2012. Under the current climate, we might consider that to be very ambitious.
Giles Tremlett, Ian Chambers and Roxanne Escobales produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.